Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught offside from the suburbs of New York City in an apartment in Brooklyn. Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
Hello, my brother. How are you?
Doing well. Beautiful, beautiful fall day here in the Northeast. Happy to be alive. What's new?
I feel exactly the same way. The sun is shining. The leaves are turning. I went for a hike at the weekend in Peekskill.
Oh. Ooh. Peekskill,
New York. Absolutely gorgeous.
You're taking in that foliage.
Oh, I try to resist it. I try to be a more kind of different guy in many aspects of my life, but the foliage just gets you. And the clean air, and you got that nice sweat on. Do you know what I mean? You felt like you were exerting yourself. You got your 10,000 steps in on your Fitbit in the gorgeous weather. And amazing, amazing. And it all happened on Saturday, which was an amazing day as well.
Yes. Yes, it was. Let's see. We have a big podcast coming up for you today. Lots to talk about in the Premier League, including, as you put it, Manchester United on, what was it, spin cycle?
The spin cycle, the rinse repeat.
We'll talk about that.
I just looked at the rundown today, guys. I saw Andrew's questions and I felt like Bill Murray, and I wanted to hammer at an alarm clock as Sonny and Cher played Babe. I got you, babe. Groundhog Day for everyone.
Also, MLS, we have our postseason, and a little club in Chester, Pennsylvania has their trophy, JJ.
Yes.
Philadelphia Union.
The little engine that could.
Well, I mean, they kind of were, and good for them. So we'll talk about that. We've got a mailbag with a very, very interesting question about soccer conspiracy theories, which I think will be fun to dive into. And we also have red cards, man of the match. Also, JJ, I woke up this morning, as I tend to do, and I leaned over and I opened up Twitter and gave a quick glance through. And one thing that I saw on there is that Amazon Prime released a trailer today, for a new limited, I guess, like a mini series called El Presidente about the FIFA scandal.
Yes. They just dropped that into our lives. I haven't even seen the trailer, but some of our listeners have alerted me to it, and they want a critic's corner, a deep dive, a review into it. So, of course, what will happen is I'll watch the whole thing, and you'll be on episode one, and it'll never happen. No, but we will.
First of all, I lapped you in Lasso.
Yeah. Strangely, the password for Apple, our Apple password failed on episode 8 of Lasso. So I am stuck with 2 or 3 episodes to go in Lasso. So I haven't finished it.
By the way, I should tell you that a mutual friend of ours, Peter Rosenberg, who, by the way, for those listening, hosts another ESPN podcast, Cheap Heat. I'll give that a quick plug. He just started watching Lasso, JJ.
He loves it.
Absolutely loves it.
Of course he does.
Loves it. Because he understands that there is a place for light humor in our lives. Not everything needs to be Citizen Kane.
No, exactly. And I'm not criticizing anyone. If you enjoy it, you enjoy it. But let's be honest, Rosenberg this is built for Rosenberg. It's got the appropriate amount of schmaltz for him. It's about something foreign from England. He can have a laugh at all the curiosities. Put Peter Rosenberg in London and he would do all the American touristy things. That he would be, oh my God, he would be the loud American
London. I don't know about any of this. This doesn't feel accurate at all. It's like you don't even know the guy. All right, let's start with the real show, JJ. Let's take a look back over the course of this past weekend. Start with what typically over the last few seasons has been the marquee match of the season, and that is Liverpool and Manchester City. They play out a 1-1 draw. It was kind of the tale of two games within one game. The first half, I thought, was a really fun, enjoyable watch. The second half, it kind of died down a little bit and sort of petered out. A 1-1 draw, is it a result that both teams would take? Or do you think maybe Manchester City, having missed a penalty in this one, are going to be looking back, and them needing to make up a lot of ground as well, might look back on this one and thought, damn.
Yeah, you know, I think you can look at it both ways, but with the jovial and warm embrace that both managers had at the end of the game and almost the glowing terms in which they spoke about each other afterwards, like Klopp was was saying how it was such a great game. It was the fascinating game. He was paying City a lot of credit. And equally, Pep Guardiola was talking about how it's a disaster for Trent Alexander-Arnold to be injured, as if he was one of his own players. So there was a kind of a mutual backslapping. Aren't we great? Look at what we've produced in this league. We are of the highest order kind of feeling. And I think both managers are okay. And you take away the fans out of it, you take away that element, and it definitely neuters it. It definitely neutered that game yesterday. That did not have the sting of the rivalry that we've seen of the past two seasons. On I would say on the balance of play, both managers are right. I was happy with a draw, especially as the game seemed to end around the hour mark. You felt as if, right, well, this is done now. There was a appreciable drop in intensity. It was at one point in the first half like a basketball end-to-end game. After an early, say, 20 minutes of Liverpool dominance, then City grew into the game. And there was we looked set for a classic, but for whatever reason, probably workload over the last few weeks and three games in the space of 7 days, almost every week for the last few weeks, the game petered out, I guess. And I don't think we learned a whole lot about either side, Andrew. I don't think we can come away with any giant conclusions, except they're probably still the best two teams in England.
Well, that in itself is an interesting conclusion to draw.
Just at the moment,
more so about Manchester City than Liverpool.
Yeah, I'm not ready to put them on the scrap heap already. I do think we're at the end of an era. I do think it could be the end of a cycle for them, but they're still potent. They could still hold the best team in England or the champions to account. It's not like Liverpool, although it looked early like Liverpool had the potential to blow them away, they didn't. Equally, City in their attack weren't able to punish Liverpool. I also think if you look at other games that happened this weekend, it's very hard to discount Manchester City from this title race.
Yeah, that's all fair. A couple questions in this that jumped to mind for me. For one, if we're talking about just like the viewing experience for neutrals, I wonder if the De Bruyne penalty miss was as detrimental to neutrals as it was to Manchester City. Like, you just wonder if he scores there and City go up, okay, is it going to force Liverpool to then kind of like chase that game and continue to really attack, which we see how exciting they can be when they play that way. Maybe the game is a little bit more fun if that penalty goes in.
Sure. You're right. And also with the way Liverpool set up with both Jota and Firmino playing, and almost like this vacant midfield of it, at some points in the game, certainly early on, it was almost like a 4-2-4, which was, you know, evident in the way Liverpool attacked and the gaps they found, particularly usually as they always do behind City's fullbacks. Maybe it could have been. Maybe it forces Liverpool's hand and Liverpool and City go toe to toe again for the second half. I would think that would probably be it. Maybe Kevin De Bruyne dragging that wide was the final whistle.
The Jota thing is interesting, and that was the other thing I was going to ask about. So last week, before Liverpool's Champions League match, we talked about how it seemed like he was forcing his way into this lineup, that he was going to just play his way in and give Jurgen Klopp no choice. And we were wondering, okay, well, Liverpool have their formation that has worked so brilliantly for them over this last few seasons, so who's going to have to come out for Jota to go in? And then Jurgen Klopp throws us this curveball and decides that the candidate that had kind of emerged in Roberto Firmino, they can both play. They can all play. Jota, Firmino, Mane, Salah. I mean, and like you said, it created this kind of two-man midfield in which there was a lot of space. And I guess it's a little bit of why it surprises me to hear you still anoint City as being a top two team, because I feel like City of last year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, with a midfield that wide open, I don't know. And no Virgil van Dijk in the back and Trent Alexander-Arnold out of the game relatively early. To me, that's just not a game that ends with Manchester City only scoring one goal.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. But I had a little look at what you're talking about there with City, Andrew, statistically. And I guess I hadn't really thought about it, because I have been fairly consistent saying that while I think City are at the end of the cycle, they're still doing Manchester City things. But I look at big chances created thus far in this season, Andrew. The big chances created table. Where do you think City are on that?
Well, it's you, and you have a point that you're trying to make, so I would imagine they're very high.
No, they aren't.
Oh, so...
In fact, they're ninth. They're behind Chelsea, Brighton and Hove Albion, Leeds United, Everton, Crystal Palace. Yeah, top of the table is Tottenham Hotspur with 21 big chances created. Second is Aston Villa with 18. And third is Liverpool with 17. So that I found that interesting. And then big chances missed was another stat I decided. I just pull up. And City are fifth in the table for big chances missed. Top of that table are Leeds United, Liverpool and Tottenham. So there is a lack of a cutting edge here that we can definitely discern.
And the goal that they scored, a lot of people think kind of happened by accident. I don't know if I am of that mind. I kind of want to give Gabriel Jesus the benefit of the doubt that first touch was just brilliant.
Well, he's claiming the first touch.
As he should.
And also, it kind of reminded me a little bit, not exactly, obviously, of Dennis Bergkamp's disputed goal against Newcastle. You know the turn he does on Nikos Dabi's ass? That just amazing turn that I've actually probably never seen anyone do again. And Arsenal fans fly into a rage. Of course he meant it. He's the greatest, one of the greatest technicians ever to play the game. I'm not sure he meant it. Shea Given isn't sure he meant it. And he was the goalkeeper who saw the whole thing unfurl in front of him. But I felt there was a little bit of the Bergkamp about Jesus. But, you know, if he scores, people forget because of the missed penalty, that header, he should have scored that too.
Yes.
And then we're talking a different game as well. But there is something at the core of City. There is a bluntness for sure that we can see in the team. And I think you're right to point it out and put it on our rundown.
Well, your hero has questions about it too, JJ. Roy Keane said this on Sky Sports. He said, City, when you look at their squad and the players they've lost, but also to go into the season when they're expected to challenge for every competition they're in, to have two strikers and Aguero being 32, having one or two problems, and then just hanging your hat on the one striker, they'd have to be critical of themselves. Why didn't they strengthen in the summer with another striker?
Yeah, I mean, he makes some good points there as well. He also called Sergio Aguero, I mean, he didn't say fat, but he said... He wanted to know what size shorts he was wearing. He thought that Aguero at the start of the season looked overweight. In the same batch of analysis, he also called Kyle Walker an idiot. He was asked, how does Kyle Walker end up giving away that penalty to Sadio Mane? And he says, because he's an idiot. Which...
I mean, it was clumsy. Idiot is strong.
Idiot is too strong.
These things happen.
Yeah, of course they do.
Right. It wasn't, you know.
Now, if I'm putting money on someone to do it, we've seen it before with Kyle Walker. I don't understand why managers don't give the instruction unless the ball is winnable to poke it away. I don't mean go to ground. I mean to poke it away. Don't make a tackle in the penalty box. Get yourself goal side between the ball and the goal. That's all you can do. And yeah. He just went flying in and hip-checked Mane. And one other thing from this game that irked me a little bit. I try to avoid as much as possible talking about VAR because I feel it slows down the pod. It's not fun. It's not what we want to talk about. And it's frustrating. Mm-hmm. And to get a tweet from somebody during the game, oh, how long is JJ going to talk about the VAR decision for the handball that led to De Bruyne's penalty? Well, here's your answer. I'm not. I can see why it was given. I can also see why the rule doesn't really work. I can also see why it wasn't intentional. I can also see why a ball being pinged at you in the wet like that as you're running in stride can end up in a handball. But I'm not complaining. The penalty was given. There we go. Them's the rules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's not a ton left to say about it. It is what it is.
We can't do this every week.
No, and we haven't. We've pretty much stopped over the last month.
The idea that I'm going to cry about these decisions, I find nothing more tedious. Other than listening to Andrew's stories.
You find that nothing more tedious. You're the criminal here.
Oh, am I the criminal?
I've seen your Twitter account.
Yeah.
All it is a steady stream of whining consciousness. But anyway. Let's move on now. The other club in Manchester, Manchester United, their roller coaster ride continues. Perhaps, JJ, another stay of execution for Ole?
I mean, if you were putting money on this result, who was it tweeted? I can't remember, said, guaranteed there'll be, after they lost to Istanbul Başakşehir during the week, who was it? I can't remember who it was. They said, guaranteed, nailed on, they'll beat Everton 2-0 at the weekend.
Well, the funny thing is, because we talked about how Ole, he just allows the situation to reach critical mass and right. then finds a way out of it, like some kind of like Norwegian superhero.
It's like that weird, do you remember that weird film that I was always too scared as a kid to watch? Flatliners, where they'd take themselves to the brink of death.
Yes. Yeah, it's an amazing point. That is his managerial stay so far at Manchester United. And it was even like, so all this pressure is on them because of what happened midweek in the Champions League. And then they go down pretty quickly within the first 20 minutes or so to Everton. And it's just like, well, this is like Twitter was already ablaze with like final nail in the coffin jokes.
Right.
And then they come back and score three straight. And it's just like this game in itself was the perfect encapsulation of this guy's time at this club. He gets right to the edge and then just kind of like finds his way out of it. I don't know how long, like, I don't think this is sustainable, but
he stares
up till now it is.
He stares into the beyond to discover what is the afterlife and then comes back to life.
Yeah.
Just right to the edge.
Some of it has to be, this idea also of, it's not just him like rescuing himself every time. It must just also be like, well, who are you going to bring in instead? Like if they had a clear option, then I can't believe, I just have to think that this probably would have ended at some point, but maybe they just don't see a natural alternative. So they figure, well, let's not just pay him to go away and then pay someone else that we don't really want to be here that we'll probably wind up firing when somebody even more prominent comes along. So they're just going to ride this roller coaster for as long as they can until a better option presents itself.
Yeah. And I mean, even last week, The Athletic were reporting that if Ole Gunnar Solskjaer loses at the weekend, Manchester United lose rather, he'll still remain as manager. They're not firing him. They're committed to this project of nostalgia for now. So here we go again. The same questions. Stay of execution. Yes. Granted, even before the Everton game at the weekend, before he flatlined and then came back to life as he did. And United did United things. They did the things we've seen them do. The third goal was very much a United goal. Cavani's first goal for the club, which I thought, look, Bruno Fernandes was brilliant in the game. The goal was scored on the break as Everton pushed for an equaliser. What was interesting, I thought that Fernandes had an excellent game. And I think in and around the box, creating chances, releasing the fullbacks, particularly Shaw, Fernandes was excellent. And he kind of linked that whole thing together. And even Matt, I thought Mata was okay too. And it was interesting how Ole Gunnar Solskjaer went for that option. And again, we saw Paul Pogba on the sideline. He's gone back to, Pogba was out of the picture, then he was back into the picture, and now he's gone out of the picture again.
So he is, to me, he is becoming one of the more intriguing elements of this club right now.
I'm bored by it.
This Pogba dilemma. And you just wonder now, with him sitting in five of their last seven matches across all competitions, is this guy ever going to live up to the expectations he had at this club?
No, is the honest answer. So yeah. There was some really good reporting around Manchester United over the last couple of weeks that said, I think it was from Miguel Delaney, to give him his due, that Solskjaer toyed with the idea of him playing in, because what's the refrain, Andrew? The refrain is, but look how he plays for France. Well, he plays in a different position for France. And Solskjaer looked at playing him in that same position for Manchester United, which is a deeper lying role. And Pogba said, I hate that role. I don't want to do that. So he obviously will give himself up for the team for France, but he won't do it for Manchester United. So that's one avenue closed off. When he does play, he's slow, he's ponderous on the ball. Ken Early made a good point last week saying he's kind of like a player that would have been brilliant 20 years ago when the game wasn't so quick. So what do you do with him? I've seen him succeed once, really, in a out-and-out position where Jose Mourinho played him to the left of a three, an attacking three against Everton at Goodison Park. That's almost 3 years ago now. You know, maybe you just move on. It's not working. It clearly isn't working. And as talented as he is, Andrew, we don't see enough of it. And I don't know what else to say. I don't find this intriguing anymore. It's intriguing how they'll plot his exit strategy because his contract's not up till the following summer. Someone asked us on Twitter, a listener, how much would you get for him now? If someone offered 60 million, would you just take it? Probably.
Yeah, 60, I think I would. And I think you have to be willing. This guy's not playing for them. And when he does, he's average. He's not a standout player. He has moments where he's like, there he is, but like not over the course of 90 minutes. So if you get 60 for him, then you're getting that basically just on reputation and not certainly on performance, at least over the last few seasons.
Would you not be better? Sorry to cut across, Andrew. Yeah. Would you not be better to try and find a place for Donny van de Beek, a permanent role for Donny van de Beek, rather than, you know, this rinse repeat, constant trying to make this work with Pogba? That's the way I feel.
But the problem with Pogba is, as long as he's on your team, then it serves you for a couple reasons to want to play him. Not only because there still has to be this belief deep down inside that, like, you know, you've seen what he can do. We have to find a way to unlock this. So there's always that element of wanting to play him. But the other one is what we're just talking about in the transfer situation with him. If you do want to get something for him, the only way to increase his value is to play him. Like if he's just collecting dust on the bench, the value is just going to keep dropping and dropping. You'll lose all your leverage in any negotiation. So, you're right. Like every part of me wants to say if it's Pogba or Van de Beek, and I don't necessarily know that it's down to one or the other.
No, it's not.
If it is those two, though, I'm very much in the Van de Beek camp. I'd rather just say, okay, let's move on from Pogba. It's not going to work here. The managers have changed, but his performances have not. So move on. But I don't know that it can really be that simple. And it's interesting that you mentioned the France element of this because even Didier Deschamps weighed in on it this week. And he talked about how Pogba hasn't been getting minutes at United and how he must be disappointed. He said Pogba hadn't played for a while. He's in a situation with his club where he cannot be happy, neither with his playing time nor with his positioning. Deschamps may be taking a not so subtle shot at Solskjaer and the way that he's chosen to use Pogba.
Yeah, well, I mean, Didier Deschamps should look at all the different roles this guy's been played in. We've seen him recently starring in the diamond formation. We've seen him previously, like I said, wide on the left of a three. We've seen him everywhere. It's not working. He's not working. You know, he built up this massive reputation in Italy, comes on the back of that. United had to have him, and then they got him, and they weren't sure quite what to do with him. His performances have dipped. Just call time on this right now.
Yeah. One note on Everton before we leave this match. You mentioned the third goal before. The first one that Manchester United scored was the one that was most worrisome to me, A, because it was in such close proximity to the goal Everton scored. It seemed like there was a little bit of a letdown for them that allowed United right back into the game when maybe Everton could have kind of put their foot on United's throats in a moment where United are probably really feeling the heat. And that goal in particular, I mean, like, I wonder if we're going to have to start asking questions a little bit of Everton's defending, like to allow no pressure on, I think it was Luke Shaw who played in that ball. He's just free to do whatever he wants with it. And then for Bruno Fernandes to just like coast right through the center of Everton's defense and no one mark him, no one even really turn around to face. It was just such an easy goal from beginning to end. And you just wonder, you know, we kind of thought Michael Keane, some of these players in Everton's defense were ready to kind of take that next step. But in the last couple of games, you wonder if maybe no, not quite yet.
Yeah, I rewatched the highlights this morning of that game, and on that goal, which was not identical exactly, but almost identical to the goal that was it Shaw swung in the cross for Bruno Fernandes, and then it was Bruno Fernandes who put in the cross for Rashford, two headers just like that, and they seem to ghost in late arrivals in the box and no one close to them. Seamus Coleman doesn't close down on either goal, but I look back at one of them, and I can't remember which one it was. But Coleman was constantly caught with United's overloads on that wing, Andrew. He was on his own. And I thought, how is that possible? Where's the defensive midfielder? Or where's the midfield? Coleman's playing on the same side as James Rodriguez. And on one of the goals, you can see James just not tracking back, not picking up, not helping Coleman out. So when Coleman and James look good linking together, like we saw earlier on in the season, away at Crystal Palace, good going forward, backwards, we're seeing the problems in having a player like James Rodriguez.
Yeah, a couple more we wanted to get to, JJ. Aston Villa just lay it down on Arsenal. And you wonder now if they are emerging as the new candidate for most pleasant surprise of the season. I would think right now it has to be them.
I 100%. I watched this game, before we get to Arsenal, I will just say this. Arsenal were dreadful, shocking, as bad as I've seen them at any point in the last few years. But the goals Villa scored, particularly the Ollie Watkins one from close in, where I think it's Matty Cash plays a diagonal to Ross Barkley on the left-hand side, volleys it first time across the box.
It's the assist of the season so far.
Oh, gorgeous. First time volley straight across. Absolutely gorgeous. Villa were outstanding, Andrew. And now it's time for JJ's tasty stats, which is becoming, people love when I get into these tasty stats, which is just like that first sip of a cup of coffee on a cold morning. Andrew,
we got to get Tasty Cake in on a sponsorship. It's just waiting for it.
Let's get on it. Come on. Tasty Stats, sponsored by Tasty Cakes. You know, StatsBomb issue those radars.
Okay. Yeah.
They do that whole thing. And they've released one for Jack Grealish that even if you didn't know how these radars work, it's just gorgeous to look at. Andrew, fouls won, open play, XG assists, shots, touches in box. The radar, the spider's web is right out to the edge of the circle. Successful dribbles too. It's gorgeous. This is just one of the beautiful radar maps of Jack Grealish, which I will tweet out later.
I love him. I love him as a player, JJ.
Oh, Andrew, suffice to say, he is in the form of his career. It is so good to watch. To say he ran that game is an understatement. And look, there was magnificent performances from Aston Villa players right through the ranks, but this was something special. Really, really amazing performance. And I talked about throwback players in Pogba. Grealish with the kind of socks down low and the way he runs and the way he takes players on. I mean, the third Villa goal, it's just a thing of beauty. Jack Grealish, it makes me so sad now that he's in an England side that doesn't...
We can't do this again.
In an England side that doesn't want him. He could have 50 caps for Ireland already. He could be captain and a hero. Ugh, just a wonderful performance from him.
I also have a tasty stat for you, my friend.
Ooh.
And I'm sorry if this is an offensive way of putting it to Aston Villa, but this is kind of from the category of one of these things is not like the others. JJ, most goals per game in Europe's top five leagues. Number one, Bayern Munich at 3.9. Number two, PSG at 2.6. And number three, Aston Villa at 2.57, tied with Atalanta and Sassuolo.
Good Lord. These are heady days for Dean Smith's team.
I mean, can we at least, like, I know you mentioned him before, but like that number, like them being where they're at in terms of goals per game, Ollie Watkins, to make this jump from the Championship to the Premier League and be able to score goals like this, he's been, I mean, we were talking last week about signings of the season. I don't know that we mentioned his name. And if we
did.
Okay. I did. All right, good.
Yeah.
Because he's been unbelievable for them. And by the way, this game, the fact that the first goal for Villa, which they scored in the just opening seconds, sometimes the obstruction rule with goalkeepers, it's another one of these vagaries that
I think he's in the way. And genuinely, I think you have to call that.
All right, fair enough. Now, I will say, typically when someone is in the way and a goal is scored, the goalkeeper loses his mind and chases down the referee. And Leno did not react at all.
No.
He didn't point at anything. He didn't hold up a hand or anything. And I kind of use those guys as my gauge in those situations of just how egregious it may or may not be. And by him not reacting, I kind of didn't think much of it. Now, when you see the replay, you're right. It is, I guess, kind of hard to argue with. But in the moment, to me, like, there was no part of me that thought this is coming back.
I mean, the ball was smashed past him. He didn't have a chance to even know what was going on.
Yeah. Now they are right now. They're no joke. We'll see if this can continue. But right now, they're one of the most fun teams to watch in the league. You wanted to mention Arsenal too.
Yeah, quick word on Arsenal. I think when we talked about this new Arsenal under Arteta, we said they're a lot more resilient. They're kind of much more compact, and they know how to play a certain way, which often is putting together moves on the break. And I was reading James McNicholas in the wake of that defeat to Aston Villa, and he wrote this in The Athletic, and I thought it was interesting that we've reached the point for Arteta that may mean loosening the shackles on his team. He's a stickler for detail. The Spaniard spent the majority of the match against Villa giving precise instructions to each player, frequently instructing them on their next pass. He may have to learn to grant more trust to his players, even improvisational mavericks like Nicolas Pepe and Willock. He certainly can't persist with an attack structured around the out-of-sorts pair of Lacazette and Willian. The Frenchman's leaden-footed performance was in stark contrast to that of Ollie Watkins, bright and busy as Villa's spearhead. So we talk about the Pep school and how everything's orchestrated, and that maybe as much as he's a detailed guy, he needs to loosen the shackles a little bit. I saw Pepe against, I know it's Dundalk in the Europa League, I know that, but he is that improvisational talent that could really help that attack. And maybe it's time to release the chains, release the shackles, as McNicholas points out.
And then finally, JJ, close with this. In looking at this past weekend in the Premier League, you look at the top of the table right now, and it's like getting in a time machine back to a few years ago. Leicester City first and Tottenham second. Here we are. We meet again.
Yes.
A little bit of PTSD when I first looked at that and saw those two at first and second there. Harry Kane coming up huge again for Tottenham. I don't know what else you can say about
it. Can we talk quickly about that? So
the ball played into him.
Doherty's ball is really good, because you think it's a straight diagonal or pinged into him, but its trajectory, you think the keeper should get it, and it entices the keeper, and it's a total mistake. And Kane somehow guides it home. It's such a good goal. But, you know, again, I'll go to the resident Tottenham supporter in my house, my girlfriend. She said they weren't good again. And again, they're finding ways to win. Now, I think that's a positive, but you wonder, can they do this for an entire season? In a season which I think, with the squad they have assembled, with all the tools Mourinho has now got at his disposal, they really should be challenging for the championship.
Which they are. And also, to say, can they do this for an entire season implies that it's what they've done so far this season. And I don't know that that's necessarily the case. They've had some brilliant performances, and they've had some not so brilliant performances. Okay. And I think that that kind of mirrors most clubs that are, you know, challenging for titles. I mean, you have your exceptions with teams that are great every single game, but you know, like Manchester City, even in their record-breaking season, how many games did they eke by that we talked about with those 2-1s where they'd get one in like the 88th minute?
But I'm asking you, what I'm asking you is, do you fundamentally think that, here's what I'll put to you, the players are there, the style of play has not changed significantly.
Well, and it has in one massive way that has changed the complexion of their entire attack. Well, not just, yes, shots, but why are those shots getting created? Harry Kane's role has changed.
Right.
He's not a number nine for them. He is a true 10. He lies deeper and deeper, it seems like, every game. He's the primary distributor, it seems like, for this club. And I'm not just saying that because it's an easy thing to say. Oh, look at his assist totals. He must be passing. Like, it's not even just that. You just watch the way they play, and it now all plays through him. And we've said for years how he's an underrated passer, and I think everyone is now seeing that. It's why Son's goal totals are where they are. And I have to believe this was the first game, I believe, in the league where Son, Kane, and Bale all played together.
Right.
I've got to think, as these three develop more chemistry, you'll see performances change in terms of the way that they play off one another. And I think that only time can help the dynamic between those three. And this role that Mourinho has put Kane in, Kane has taken to it. And I think it's made them a better team.
It's overall amazing. Can I give us a pat on the back? I think we're talking for 2 years about how his passing is underrated.
Yes. Yes.
And finally, the question, I hate doing this to you because it's not fair, but I'm going to do it anyway.
All right.
Do you feel that this time is a better chance for you to win the Premier League than 15-16 was? This current moment with the drop-off, with the weirdness, with the collection of Spurs players, with the turnaround in fortunes, with the whole just kind of cultural milieu that the Premier League finds itself in, is this the best time for, is this the gold? We always talk about winning time. Is this a better winning window for Spurs than 15-16 was?
The only reason that I would say no, that I don't know that I can quite say yes to that just yet, is because in 15-16, I think it was a much clearer transition season for all of the big clubs, and it presented that opportunity for Leicester and Spurs to duke it out. I think we're really close to that moment here. We've talked about Manchester City and their cycle ending, but I don't know that I can say that just yet about Liverpool. Now, we'll see. We'll continue to monitor Liverpool and their injury situation and see just how damaging the Van Dijk injury proves to be. I know Trent Alexander-Arnold is going to be out till December, but he'll be back soon enough. You know, he gets an international break here to kind of help heal. But I still feel like there's this looming shadow of Liverpool that kind of, you know, throws at least a little bit of doubt over that. And then the other thing that the Tottenham team of that year had that this one worries me a little bit with is their defending. I still just, like, that club, it was, you know, Alderweireld and Vertonghen both in their prime at the same moment, with the chemistry that those two had developed, not just at Spurs, but also playing together for the national team in Belgium. It was also, you know, Kyle Walker and Danny Rose in the midst of their primes. Tottenham have some depth, but I don't know that they have, certainly in central defense, you know, do I feel as good about Alderweireld and Dyer or Alderweireld and Davinson Sanchez as I did Alderweireld and Vertonghen? No, I don't. Alderweireld's still good, but he's 5 years older. And Dyer and Sanchez are not what Vertonghen was that season. So that's the only thing that maybe just worries me a little bit. But it's a good question. It's certainly a good question. I don't know. We'll see it play out. Why? I feel like you have an answer to that as well.
No, I think this is a very good window for big Spurs.
It is.
Spurs-y
I think they're a part of it. They're certainly a part of this title race, whether or not they're in it. And I guess right now
I can think of Spurs fans. I can think of so many Spurs fans just screaming, shut up, just shut up and move on right now. They don't want to talk like this.
Really? To say that they're a part of it? Then why even be a fan? Like, isn't this why you support and watch your team, is for moments like this when you're a part of a race?
Do you not think, though, this fan base, I don't want to go down this road. We've got too much to get to. But this is a fan base that's conditioned to expect good things to happen briefly, only for tragedy to hit. Be honest with yourself.
Yes, that is very much the ethos of the club. There's no question about it.
It's very much the ethos of your life.
Let's see. Let's take a very quick break, JJ. When we come back, we got some MLS to discuss because the regular season has come to an end. We've got a couple questions about the upcoming playoffs. We have to provide our ode to the Philadelphia Union as they take home their first trophy as a club. Plus, mailbag, red cards, man of the match. Don't go anywhere. Oh, back now. Caught offside. JJ, MLS regular season has come to an end. The postseason, we have our play-in matches coming up this week, and then the postseason begins after the international break. As we put the regular season to bed, the Supporters' Shield, JJ, the Union have done it. They win their first trophy, proving that good things do, in fact, happen, well, I'll say in Chester, after all.
Yeah, they do indeed. Can I cut across you with this moment of joy just to tell you that that supporter shield that was raised was not the supporter shield. So did you technically win it at all? Andrew Wiebe is telling us on the Twitter machine that the supporter shield didn't arrive from Los Angeles in time. So the Philadelphia Union got creative. And to make a long story short, they fashioned some member of the club. Turns out the web manager's fiance's sister's boyfriend is the proud owner of a full Captain America costume with a full metal shield. So they did some work to the shield. They covered it in some kind of coating, and they created the supporter shield that was hoisted at the Union the other night. That wasn't
You're telling me what they lifted was a Halloween costume prop?
It's slightly better. It would come under the collectible. Yeah, it's a collectible. rather than so it's actually yeah, it is amazing. They, as Weeby says, they were about to get a 16-inch pizza tray covered with a vinyl sticker when someone said, "Well, I do know a guy with a shield." So the nerd came up big with his Captain America shield, and they covered it with the – I mean, it looks amazing, to be honest with you. So that's what was raised as the supporter shield.
Can I ask a question here? Go ahead. The people who were supposed to deliver the true shield – right. Did this catch them off guard in some way? Like, they had a week, essentially, to prepare to get it to where it needed to be.
Like, Jeremy is the web manager's fiancé's sister's boyfriend. He lives in Medford, which is quite literally Brendan Aronson's hometown. He told the union he wasn't a sports fan, but it sounded like a cool idea. The team drove to Medford, got the shield, and used a heat gun to put the vinyl supporter shield over the top. And it looks good, especially in the picture. Yeah, I didn't notice until, I did notice. It's clearly not the shield, but what they were holding up is a pretty good replacement.
In terms of the team themselves, props to them. I think they started, you mentioned before, and I kind of scoffed at the notion of this, or you scoffed at the notion of the little engine that could. I think that's how we can view them now, where we can sort of roll our eyes at that idea because we see what they've become. However, I believe they had a 6% chance of winning this, according to, I guess it's like the SPI from when the season began.
And Matt Doyle of MLSsoccer.com, I was listening to him talk, and he, even after this, he doesn't believe the little engine that could will stay on the rails in the playoffs, and he doesn't believe that they're going to be the cup favorite. He started listing the kind of players, your Altidores, your Robbie Keynes, the kind of game-changing players that you need in the playoffs, and he feels Philadelphia Union don't have them. So it's as if they've just won the supporter shield. I think they're absolutely entitled to be counted as real favorites, but not according to Mr. MLS himself.
Well, here's the thing. I the fan in me wants to rip him for saying that, but I can understand where that comes from, because when you look at them, like, the thing that makes them great is this total absence of a weak link. There is none. And it makes them so difficult to break down, and it's what makes them so dangerous, and it's why they're so consistent, and you have to be consistent to win this trophy. But by the same token, like, okay, do they have the best striker or even a top five striker? No, I wouldn't. You know, they have two really good ones, but I don't think there's a top five one there between Shabilko and Santos. You know, do they have like the best midfielder? I mean, I guess Aronson can be in the conversation, but you know, is he top three? I don't know. Like, in defense, they've got really good players in defense, but do they have, like, McKenzie is really good. Kai Wagner is really good, but like, are these guys the best? Like, I don't know that you look at them and say that they're like loaded with superstars all across, up and down the field. Maybe Andre Blake, but they're now entering a postseason where he's got a broken hand. We don't know. He'll be back depending on how far they go. He could be back at some point, but okay, they're not going to have him early on. So like, I could see somebody looking at their roster and saying that maybe like the absence of those sort of type that of those types of players could maybe make them susceptible when they run into a team that has a guy who can just take over a game in a big moment. Now, whether or not the Union are going to be going up against those kind of teams remains to be seen as well. Like, if they're going to face Toronto, it's going to not be until the conference finals. Toronto still have to get to that point themselves. So, you know, I get it. But this team is a favorite. If you don't want to say they're the favorite, fine. But they are certainly a favorite. And you know, seeing them win this, this took a long time for them to get to this point. And you wonder now if they've broken through in a way where this can now be sustained, and they can now kind of like just be one of these elite clubs. Because this was like the way that they went about team building. Like, this, they were an afterthought. They were not a team that made big splashes. And now it's like, you listen to, you know, I'd even go so far as to say they've become almost like a model of development. And yeah, it's one thing for me and you to say that, but like, look around the league. I saw this written in MLSsoccer.com. And it, like, Axel Schuster, CEO at Vancouver, he said, "One of my role models is Philadelphia," revealed the German, "the way they built that team over years. Thierry Henry, spoke about it. He said, I always use the hashtag dupe Philadelphia Union as an example. I was there when Jim Curtin started, and it wasn't really that, but they gave him time to bring in players. They gave him time to put in place his system, and now Philadelphia is at the top of the standings. You know, these clubs that want to make quick, rational or irrational decisions, getting rid of managers after one season where they underachieve, you know, not developing homegrown talent and instead trying to make big splashes, you know, the Union may be this kind of symbol that that doesn't need to be the way. And if you give a manager time and, you know, he turns out to be the right guy, like Jim Curtin clearly has, then this can work. So congratulations to them. They stayed the course and they are now reaping the benefits of that.
Yeah. And before this turns into the Union Hour podcast, we should probably talk about the rest of the playoffs.
So the playoff, well, first, they just won the Supporters' Shield. This is their first trophy. You complete an utter D. All right. The rest of the playoffs. So the playoff picture is set. I have really two main questions for you. Okay. Which matchup are you most looking forward to and the team that you feel best about heading into the postseason? Let's start with the matchup that you're most looking forward to.
Yeah, I'm actually most looking forward to Orlando and NYCFC. Because for me, there's two teams here that came into the league in 2015 and haven't quite established themselves in a number of ways, be it NYCFC's lack of a stadium that the fans are craving to really cement themselves as a club in this city, or whether it's Orlando or the fact that they've been like bad, just bad since the beginning and have slowly but surely been sold off as a club. It's only last month we heard that someone's going to try and they're up for sale for $400 million. So it also coincides with these two teams being actually good on the field. Orlando have, as we saw in MLS's back trophy tournament cup play, were pretty good. And they've Oscar Pereja, I think, is building something there. Equally, maybe not equally, but I think Ronny Dalia, after a slow start, has made things better. They're in their best form right now of the season. So there's a lot on the line here. There's trauma amongst NYCFC fans over what's happened in the playoffs last season and pretty much every other season that they've qualified for it, including the thrashing by Toronto. Well, Toronto has been part of their their problems with their psyche on two separate occasions. So they need a deep run in this playoff series. And Orlando, as good as they've been, they need that too to cement the progress that Oscar Pereja has done. And, you know, the two fan bases don't like each other either. I think this is a really good matchup. And it could be, I think it's going to be full of goals too. I think this could be an end-to-end one. That's the one I'm going to pick.
I'm glad you picked that one. That was actually my runner-up for this. But instead, for me, the one that I chose as my clear winner, it was pretty obvious for me, and that's out west. And you look at number two, the second seed Seattle against seventh seeded LAFC. Yeah. And if you're Seattle, you just look at that and you think, oh, really? Like, you're seventh? I mean, LAFC, this is not your normal seven seed coming into this postseason. And on top of that, like, you wonder, does LAFC have the added motivation of the Seattle Sounders spoiling their dream season a year ago? So I think this could have been a conference finals matchup and nobody would have batted an eye. Star power all over the place. Vela, Rossi, who just took home the golden ball or the golden boot, Morris, Lodero, Rui Diaz, so on and so forth. Like, this is the one postseason series more than any other that is, like, to me, just the ultimate in MLS must-see TV. I guess the X factor to identify one coming in is going to be LAFC's defending. They give up goals. We know that about them. And Seattle score goals. We know that about them. Seattle just beat San Jose 4-1 over the weekend. So, like, this is the potential fatal flaw for LAFC. Is it going to bite them in this moment, or are they able now with Vela back, with Rossi playing well, can they just kind of outscore their greatest weakness? I don't know who to pick. Like, I'm leaning Seattle, but man, this is like, how do you think Seattle felt when they realized that this is who they're going to be winding up after this, like, good, really good season that they've had? You're supposed to be rewarded with a crud team in the first round, and now they got that in a one-off.
I think they've got their supporters anyway. I can't speak for the players. Their supporters will, they'll come into this they'll come into this buoyant, Andrew. They're not afraid of LAFC. They'll say, let's do to them what we've done to them before in the playoffs. They're not worried.
Yeah, fair. And then the other question, let me go first here because I don't want to be too repetitive with the stuff you said, because the team that I'm feeling best about heading into the postseason, aside from some of the more obvious candidates, is one that you just mentioned, and that is actually NYCFC. Because, like, remember what we thought about them before the season? I think we thought pretty highly of them, and then they struggled a little bit. They got rocked by the injury bug. But, like, look at them now and the way they've adjusted. And we talk all the time about how with the postseason, it's important to be playing your best soccer at the right time, and they are. They enter the playoffs, four straight wins. Within that, a 1-0 over Toronto FC, one of the favorites, putting up a nice a five spot against the Red Bulls, JJ, and then for good measure, 4-3 over Chicago this past weekend. Now, the three goals that they leaked to Chicago is a little bit eye-opening, but those three were in the first half. They settled in the second half. They got the winner, didn't give anything up. Castellanos right now on fire, hat-trick against the Red Bulls, six goals in his last seven games. And like you said, now they've got Orlando City, which for me, it was my second best matchup. For you, it was your best matchup. Hard to pick a winner in this right now, but I would lean NYCFC. I feel good about them heading in.
I've gone with the Columbus Crew, Andrew. A team that's 9 out of 10 home games won. So they're a good home side. They face the New York Red Bulls, who I don't know what to expect from them in this playoff series. But I think that if you look at Columbus, the players they have available, even their manager, Caleb Porter, there's a sense of being there, done that about them. This is an experienced enough side. If it's Harrison Afol, if it's Darlington Nagbe, if it's a center mid... if it's Jassy Zardes at the center forward position, I just think this is a team that's experienced enough. I think they'll get over the Red Bulls. And if they do that and they can stay injury free, I fancy that they'll be, I don't know. I feel good about them anyway.
Yeah, they're good.
I know they're good. I know they were extra good at the start and then they kind of dropped away a little bit. But I think this is a team to be reckoned with. And I just have a gut feeling about them.
Fair enough. So the playoffs, we still have time. We'll get into it even deeper as we close in on it. Should be fun. Should certainly be fun. You have a mailbag here, I believe.
Stunning mailbag. Atsio Soccer Pod on Twitter, Caught Offside ESPN on the Instagram, caughtoffsidepod@gmail.com for your longer emails, but don't make them too long. Ethan Ace, one of the great names. Unless it's Ethan Ake, then I feel bad. But Ethan Ace begins with, saw a funny question on Reddit today. What's a football conspiracy that you believe is true? I liked Burnley has never used their away kit and it's always raining at the King Power Stadium. Would be interested in hearing whether or not you two have a favorite. Well, I'm not sure either of those are conspiracies, but rather urban myths. But here's my favorite conspiracy, which was perpetrated by an actual conspiracy perpetrated by Chile in a World Cup qualifier for Italia 90. Chile went into the game knowing only a win would be enough to qualify for Italia 90. In the 69th minute, losing by 1-0 against Brazil, goalkeeper Roberto Rojas collapsed to the ground with blood pouring from a head wound. Near to him lay a flare apparently thrown by a Brazilian fan in the crowd. The Chilean team rushed towards Rojas, carried the goalkeeper off the field in protest. They refused to return to the field of play and they gave referee Juan Carlos Lostao no option but to abandon the match. Then suspicions grew over coming days as to the authenticity of Rojas' injuries, and soon Argentinian photographer Ricardo Alfieri published images showing that the flare had in fact landed yards from where the goalkeeper was standing. A week later, Rojas was given a life ban from professional football by FIFA. Several other figures in the Chile national team set up and football association were also punished. Brazil were awarded a 2-0 victory, eliminating Chile from the 1990 World Cup. The Chileans were also banned from entering the qualification tournament for USA in 94. Rojas later confessed to hiding a razor blade in his left glove, which he used to inflict his injuries. The plan had been hatched in the lead up to the game at the Chilean training camp. Knowing that no Chilean side had won away to Brazil in a competitive match, it was apparently decided at the first signs of provocation from opposition players or fans, the team would leave the field of play in order for the game to be abandoned and a win awarded for Chile, or maybe even a replay at a neutral venue.
That's astounding.
It's just so wild to me. This wasn't some backwater qualifier. This was Chile versus Brazil, CONMEBOL qualifying for the 1990 World Cup. Unbelievable. And by the way, the woman who threw the flare Rosaneri Melo de Nascimento ended up posing for Brazilian Playboy. She became a mini celebrity herself before her untimely death in 2011.
Just imagine, incredible, like the intimidation factor that Brazil has on their opponents, where instead of thinking, okay, let's go out there and just win this game, let's just play better than them today. No, no, no. The thinking is, okay, let me hide a razor blade in my gloves so like we have this like this other way out that we can try to escape this game without losing. Like the idea of just beating them was so foreign to Chile that they had to go to these lengths. That's amazing.
Yeah, you can read the full account of that on thesetpieces.com.
So I found a couple here, JJ. The only one that I could really think of off the top of my head was Lasagna Gate, which horrifies me and has been so well documented that I didn't feel like even going that deeply back into it. So I just kind of Googled soccer conspiracies. And ironically enough, only a month ago, 442 Magazine actually did a feature on the craziest football conspiracy theories. Here, they had like 30 of them. I highlighted just three that I found most interesting.
Okay.
This first one, this is the headline of it. Messi and Iniesta sent coded messages to the Syrian militia during the 2012 Clásico. Syrian state television, JJ, alleged that the passing patterns between Iniesta and Messi were drawing out a map of how militia groups could smuggle weapons into the country. This is truly unbelievable. The second one here, how about this one? Arsene Wenger signed Dennis Bergkamp for Arsenal while Wenger was still a manager in Japan. So who is it? Bruce Rioch, who claimed credit for the move. But I'm reading here, but it's since emerged that none other than Arsene Wenger, then the Grampus 8 manager, advised the Gunners to bring the Dutchman to Highbury. Does that mean Wenger was already de facto Arsenal boss before he officially took charge a year later? Quite possibly. And then this last one, JJ, which once again comes from CONMEBOL and involves Brazil. Argentina spiked Brazil's drinks. I'll just read from 442 where they wrote, a World Cup match between Brazil and Argentina is always going to be laced with hatred, passion, and a little flair. But tranquilizers? That's what Brazil left back Bronco is convinced happened after Argentina physio Miguel Di Lorenzo, while attending to a stricken Argentina player, gave him a water bottle. 2 days later, Bronco complained of feeling dizzy and sick after drinking from what he believed to be tranquilizer-laced water intended just for him. Now, in 2005, Diego Maradona implied the story's truth in a TV interview. Also, this quote, look, I'm not saying it didn't happen, sighed coach Carlos Bilardo soon after, his face contorting as if trying not to smile. Football had its own Watergate. There you have it.
I can't believe we got through this whole football conspiracies without full Alex Jones voice. That was...
Maybe left-wing media.
Left-wing media, of course, in conjunction with the Chinese communists are using caught offside to beam into your head this kind of left-wing nonsense, and the radical left will take over this country. By the way, you mentioned Diego Maradona there. Diego, who was had surgery for a blood clot, yeah, is to be discharged within days, according to Eurosport. So
that's great.
That's great news, because that was pretty scary for El Diego. That was a good one. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, it was fun.
Rhea tweets us. Now, Rhea is a Man United fan, so I think she's taken undue umbrage to what Megan Rapinoe has said. The team has been around since, this is referring to Rapinoe's comments, which were as follows to the BBC. It's 2020. How long has the Premier League been around? And we're only just seeing a club like Manchester United put effort and pounds towards the women's team. Frankly, it's disgraceful. And Rhea goes, the team has been around for 2 years. As a fan, I support the girls 100%. That the women's team came into existence with the decline of the men's may be coincidence. However, Rapinoe chooses to criticize the club instead of acknowledging the advantage of this move by United. I would just say she's using United as an example. Okay. Liverpool are just as culpable in this area as any other team. The Premier League has not taken having women's teams seriously, and you can spread that out across the league, in my view. And it's really just not, I think it's one where you have to take off your blinkers. She's not having to go at your club. She's having to go at a situation in women's football that she finds intolerable. Robert W., I am an American and I just got into soccer about 5 years ago. I've been listening to the pod for the last 4 years and find it a great source of information about the game and its cultural impact. However, there is something that I just don't understand, the fascination with the nutmeg. Announcers say it proudly whenever they get a chance, and social media seems to think it is the coolest thing in the world. For example, there was an Athletic article called Potent Podents, Shades of Hazard and the Nutmeg That Claimed De Bruyne's Soul. I just don't get the hyperbolic reaction to it. It seems like people equate it to a crossover dribble in basketball when the defender falls over and a three is shot in their face, but I don't see it. Could you explain this fascination with a seemingly benign defensive mistake or possibly lucky offensive skill? I would agree. The nutmeg has assumed a special status in the game. But firstly, deliberately nutmegging a player is much more common and much less of an accident than you would think. The nutmeg status comes from the fact that it is the act of putting the ball through a small space between your legs. And that is really quite embarrassing. It just is. But the main cachet of the nutmeg is that it has this paralyzing effect. It happens so quickly that you can't react. You can't suddenly close your legs that quickly. And you're often flat-footed and the play goes on while you are flailing to recover. That's the nutmeg. The nutmeg has this ability to render you paralyzed, to render you out of the game and you look foolish. Like, everybody remembers James Milner's nutmeg. Messi's nutmeg on James Milner. There's a disrespect to it. Like, as if, I can't be bothered with you. Watch me flick it between your legs so you're out of the game. John O'Shea is one of the most decorated players in Manchester United history. What will he be remembered for in his top three moments by just the regular fan? The time he nutmegged Figo. The nutmeg is a act of disrespect.
So he actually answered his own question kind of by providing the perfect analogy. Like, it is the soccer version essentially of a killer crossover that puts someone on their back. Now, whether or not you think it's as embarrassing as that, that can certainly be debated. But in the soccer community, that's what it is. I would happen to think, I think that a crossover that breaks someone's ankles, that like puts a guy down on the ground, yeah, is more embarrassing than being nutmegged. But that's the analogy.
Let me tell you, that's
the only way I could describe it to somebody.
I think you're right. But let me tell you, and again, I don't usually do this on the podcast because I hate the way it comes off. But if you've ever played at any reasonably decent level, you've been nutmegged, it's amazing how it stays with you in your psyche. I can recall two right now that have happened to me. You don't forget it. It's really quite something. Okay. Finally, we got Shireen Moore. And she's tweeted, or she sent us a link to an article about Mesut Ozil called The Erasure of Mesut Ozil. Tariq Panja and Rory Smith did a piece on it last week, I think. So he's not in the Premier League match day squads anymore on their list, their squad list. He's not in their Europa League squad list. And Mesut Ozil is this highly paid player, a World Cup winner, who is now in total isolation at Arsenal Football Club. And they kind of track the way it's happened and the number of factors that come into it. And one of the ones they talk about is his defense, or his basic looking for human rights, looking to bring attention to the issue of the Uyghurs in China. And the Uyghur, the minority Muslim population there, who have, you know, come under attack from the Chinese government, and how that played out, and how Arsenal, who, you know, everybody, just in the same way the NBA had this trouble with China, offending China, and because they have such huge monetary interests in the country, that was like part of the nail in Ozil's coffin. And then the other part was not accepting the pay cut that Arsenal players took at the start of the pandemic, and that he didn't accept this. So there's so many things going on here. I mean, Arsenal say it's nothing to do with the pay cut. That's not why he's been sidelined. And we saw an attempt last season under Unai Emery before Arteta came in, where the board basically said, we've come to the decision that he will no longer be a starter or a match day player for Arsenal. And it's just this incredible scenario that we find ourselves in. One of the world's elite players, or at least at one point, one of the world's elite players, is now just completely frozen out at Arsenal. So I would urge people to read it, but I don't know if you have any thoughts on it, Andrew. I can't say specifically what did it. I would think that it is a culmination of things and not just one thing in particular.
I'm sure isn't that usually the case, where it's hard to boil down to just one thing? It's just amazing that, like, you know, he's just wasting away. That, you know, he can't leave there. I guess his wages are such that he's just unappealing for other clubs to want to come in and try to take from them. And we haven't seen his performances really increase over, you know, when he has gotten opportunities. So I don't know what the future is for him.
It's hard to see where he fits in the current Arsenal structure.
Yeah. He doesn't. I know you said that was the last one, JJ, but there was one other mailbag question that I actually wanted you to get to.
Oh, really?
Is that okay?
That's fine. I was editing on the fly.
The Supporter Shield versus playoffs one.
Oh, okay. You want to talk about that one?
Yeah, a little bit, because I have a mental struggle with it.
Okay, because I did some editing there. Have you got that in front of you? You can read it.
Yeah, Ahmed, I believe, sent us the email. Mm-hmm. What's up, JJ? No Andrew. Interesting.
No Andrew, because you do not engage with the common man.
He continues, do you think the Supporter Shield should mean, I think he says should mean more, or to MLS players and MLS Cup. After the season wrapped up this weekend, it's just ridiculous to see that 10 teams out of 14 in a conference qualify for the Cup playoffs. Just seems like a joke. The Supporter Shield versus MLS Cup playoffs, I have this like mental back and forth with over which one should be more important than the other. Because a postseason rewards parity, and it kind of flies in the face of a system that ensures us seeing the best team get awarded champions, which is in the end what you would want out of your season. You want to know that the best team wins. But here's the deal with a postseason. So like a championship team in a league without playoffs can technically make it through a season without actually beating any of the other best teams. If you take care of business against the mediocre teams and the bad teams, and then maybe eke out a few draws against some good teams, you could conceivably win a title doing that. A postseason demands that you beat the best teams in order to win a title. There's no hiding from them. If you don't beat the best, you cannot win. To me, there's something deserving and satisfying about that. I feel like people glance over that. They say, okay, you know, oh, you just got hot at the right time. A season like the Premier League that rewards consistency throughout the course of the year. And yes, there is certainly an argument to be made for that. But I don't think you can discount the fact that in order to win a championship in a postseason league, you have to have beaten exclusively the best teams. You're not going to get some 6-0 over West Brom that boosts your goal difference and you wound up winning because of that. Like, it's not like that. You've got to beat the best.
Equally, Andrew, in a one-off game, the best team across 20, 25 games can get knocked out. And so you end up, you know, so that's the flip side to that coin, I think.
You're right. And there's, like I said, there's a legitimate argument to be made for both sides. But you could say the best team after 20 or 25 games, well, maybe the postseason proves to us that, well, they're actually not the best team, because when they played the other best teams, they couldn't win.
I think the huge issue with MLS playoffs is it's an Oprah giveaway. Everybody gets in. That would be the issue for me. Not so much a regular league season versus playoffs. It's more to do with the fact that too many teams who are bad get in.
Fair enough. All right, we'll go quickly now here through the final segment of the show with red card. You go first.
My red card, Andrew, is, I guess it's not for him, but the situation for, remember Domé Torrent?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Brazilian champions Flamengo have fired Spanish coach Domé Torrent just 10 weeks after hiring the former New York City FC boss, the club announced on Monday. You think, it must have been a dreadful start. The move was made after Flamengo suffered two heavy defeats in their last three games. Domé Torrent and his backroom staff are no longer in charge of the first team, the Rio de Janeiro club said in a statement. Flamengo are, wait for it, third in the Serie A table, 1 point behind leaders Internacional, having lost just twice in 15 games. They also won their group to qualify for the last 16 of the Copa Libertadores, a title they are defending after beating River Plate in last year's final. However, a 4-0 defeat by second place Atletico Mineiro on Sunday, coming a week after a 4-1 trouncing at home to Sao Paulo, prompted directors to act. I think that is unbelievably cruel.
That's pretty harsh.
Very harsh. And people should read Tim Vickery's piece saying that Dome Tarant is in fact a sacrificial lamb, basically a scapegoat for other things happening at the club. So, yeah, red card to Flamengo.
Interesting. All right, my red card, JJ. This had to get mentioned in this podcast, so I wanted to make sure we put it in here. Real Madrid. We spent a lot of time talking about all the things wrong at Barcelona, but after losing 4-1 to Valencia over the weekend, maybe we need to take a look at the other Spanish giant, the one who also happens to be the defending champions. 11 games, just 6 wins to show for it. They're still fourth in La Liga, but they're third in their Champions League group behind Shakhtar and Borussia Mönchengladbach. So why? What is up with this club? Here's an interesting one. Marcelo, who of course has been brilliant for Real Madrid over the years, but maybe his time of being that caliber player is ending or has ended. I saw this stat at AS, that publication. They said Madrid have played 57 league games since Zidane returned to the bench and have lost 9. Marcelo was in the lineup for all 9 of those defeats. And then there's also this from AS with regards to Casemiro. As for Casemiro, they say the stats couldn't be much clearer. Without him, the team loses. Before the 4-1 defeat to Valencia, Zidane had left Casemiro on the bench twice. On both occasions, he had to bring him in. JJ, they cannot afford to rest this guy, or they are a different team without him, and they have no suitable backup, which leads to the next part of this, their recent transfer issues. They're coming off a transfer window where Real Madrid did literally nothing. Now, part of that is because of how active they were 2 summers ago when they signed Hazard, Jovic, Militao, Mendy, Rodrigo. And like, look at that. How has that turned out? Those guys, all that money that they poured in 2 summers ago, subpar at best. I guess Mendy has been fine, but not amazing. And all those other guys have been well under what they were expecting, especially Hazard. Part of it is injuries, but that matters in terms of trying to refresh a squad. So this is not an easy fix that they have. Ultimately, still brilliant players at the club, and they're going to be a player in the title race. But like, we're talking earlier about the transition occurring in the Premier League. Maybe it's left a window open for some of the other teams to go in and grab one this year. That's not just the Premier League. Like, you have to wonder if we're seeing the same thing right now mirroring itself in La Liga with Real Madrid and Barcelona. If they're just like in these times of transition, Barcelona kind of ending the Messi cycle, and Real Madrid, I kind of thought that like Cristiano Ronaldo, like that is not really a name that should be mentioned anymore, but they're just, since he's left, I know they won that title last season, but it seems like they're just kind of having a hard time finding an identity this year. So who knows? Maybe there's another team out there who will be good enough to take advantage of a potential drop in form from the 2 usual suspects in Spain.
I'm just annoyed that Yunus Musa's goal was ruled out for Valencia during the game. That's it.
Let's see now. Man of the match.
Interesting. My man of the match comes from a piece in The Athletic, which is something I've been thinking about lately, actually. Former footballers in their 40s are being encouraged to volunteer for a new lockdown-friendly study into the early signs of dementia amid calls for the Professional Footballers Association, the PFA, to extend funding into the research. This is from Dom Fifield. Around 30 former male professionals have signed up for the study, led by Dr. Michael Gray at the University of East Anglia. It is conducted online quarterly, with the former Crystal Palace striker Mark Bright and the ex-Wales forward Ewan Roberts among those taking part. Previous research has indicated ex-footballers are up to 3.5 times more likely to die of dementia than the general population, with 5 of England's 1966 World Cup winning squad having been diagnosed with the disease. Of course, Nobby Stiles passed away last month, with the family of Sir Bobby Charlton also having confirmed he is suffering from the condition. Dr. Gray's study aims to scrutinise whether a younger generation of players who made their name in the 80s and 90s is more susceptible to the disease. You'd be hard-pushed to find anyone who has headed more balls than I did in my career, which ended in 1999, says Bright, who saw the issue further highlighted over the weekend by an appeal for more research and funding from former Blackburn striker and BT Sports Chris Sutton. The practice we used to do after training, the hours we put in, the balls we used were heavier when wet and crossed from the distance they were. It can't have been good for us. So let's try and find out. We need to understand this better. We want players, anyone over 40, and female players as well, to be involved. It's all done at home on the computer once every 3 months. A series of simple tasks which encourage speed of thought. It is lockdown friendly and convenient, and the results could be critical to us better understanding this disease. So the narrative, I hate using that term narrative, sorry, the way we've read into dementia in footballers has been, oh, they played in the 50s and 60s. They were like Jeff Astle, Bobby Charlton now, which is incredibly sad at this late age of his life to picked up this dementia. They headed a heavier, wetter ball, right? And that this, in the last, since the 80s or the 90s, guys who have only retired in the last decade or 20 years, it won't affect them. The ball was lighter. Well, this research is so important into finding out whether that is indeed true. Alan Shearer did a documentary about it last year, about his own kind of the path of discovery into heading the football. We know about Taylor Twellman's work in this country with the Think Taylor Foundation. It's just kind of scary. It's even scary for me I never played 300 games at the top flight. I never headed the ball that much, but growing up, I would have headed the ball a lot. And it makes you wonder, the ball that I used did not absorb as much water as the ball in the 60s or 70s, but you could argue the ball that was I'm playing with now or played with 10 years ago was being hit at a faster velocity. What does that mean for your brain? What does that mean for your head?
Yeah, there's still a lot of work to be done in that area. We've talked about this, since this podcast started. I feel like this has been a topic on this show and before then. So
yeah, and by the way, I'd like to appeal to the PFA, who have lots of money, enough money to pay their chairman $2 million a year. It shouldn't be a question that they invest in this. This is very important. Yeah. And maybe down the line, Andrew, we look at a game where heading is only allowed in certain areas of the pitch.
Or there's some kind of like helmet that can be created that could help. I don't know. That could help deal with that. I have no idea.
We're not wearing helmets. Okay.
I'm not talking about like a football helmet. I'm talking about like a Petr Cech type thing.
Maybe.
All right.
I'm dismissing that out of hand.
my man of the match here, JJ, Wrexham AFC, the National League side in, I believe they're in North Wales.
Yes.
Is about to become a little more high profile, I suppose, as they're being, well, potentially being purchased by Ryan Reynolds of Deadpool and Van Wilder fame and Rob McElhenney of It's Always and Sunny in Philadelphia fame. These two, mainly Reynolds, laid out their mission statement for the club over the weekend, including a commitment to always beating rivals Chester, which will obviously help win over fans. They said to use our resources to grow the exposure of the club. Both, of course, this would be in concert with protecting the heart and spirit of a community-led historical icon. But why can't the third oldest club in the world have a global appeal? They also said to reward the faith of the supporters who have stood by Wrexham AFC throughout its history by putting everything we have towards what all fans want most for the club, and that is to win, win, win. JJ, you'd assume that this could be a case of, you know, sometimes we have these ideas of Hollywood actors when they do stuff like this. It's just some cool kind of pet project to occupy their time. Mm. But this, I don't know if this quite fits the bill for that here. Reynolds added, our intention is to become part of the Wrexham story rather than Wrexham becoming part of our story. One enthusiastic supporter of the proposed deal said they've done a lot of homework. The presentation was unbelievable. They said everything you wanted to hear as a football supporter. It's like dreamland.
Yeah, I would hope that they've done their research. This is a club. It's actually quite a big club. I remember Wrexham when they were in the third division, knocking Arsenal out of the cup in 1991. You would have loved that. Mickey Thomas scored a goal from downtown, way out, smashed it past David Seaman. Good Lord. So they're quite a big club, and they've gone through the financial ringer over the last few decades. That's for sure.
Yeah. They've fallen out of league play.
So will they become, because of the Always Sunny in Philadelphia connection, will they become like a second team for you?
A second team. I don't know about that, but I will be curious about them. Like, they won't just be if I'm looking through scores of FA Cup matches or something.
Yeah.
You know, like, they will be of note to me.
Did you hear about the potential new sponsor, also Philadelphia linked?
For them, for Wrexham?
Yeah. Did you hear?
No.
Four Seasons Total Landscaping.
Very topical humor. That was.
Wow.
That was good. So yeah, so there you go. Do you have a favorite Ryan Reynolds movie, JJ?
Nope. I can't think of anything he's been in apart from Deadpool, and I didn't watch that.
You've never seen Van Wilder, huh?
I bet you'd like. Oh, I have seen Van Wilder Party Liaison, was it? Or something like that.
I don't know. The first one, I think, was just Van Wilder. I think
Van Wilder.
I was a big fan. I really enjoyed it. Also, Waiting is a underrated kind of like cult following type movie where he plays like, it's like one of these TGI Fridays type restaurants, and he's like the cool waiter at that sort of place. I think it's a very funny movie.
All right. Okay. Maybe I'll look into it more.
Yeah. So there you go. We'll be back later this week. We'll have an emergency. Can it be considered an emergency podcast if it's well laid out and planned in advance?
Yeah,
it's just a bonus podcast.
Well, I want it to be an emerge. I want a sense of excitement around this because America is back. The U.S. men's national team will take on Wales, and we will get to see the cream of our young talent, minus Josh Sargent, of course, who was injured. But I'm excited about this. This is where me and you, we made our bones, really, doing these kind of reaction to U.S. men's national team podcasts.
I know. And God, it's been, what was it? I saw somebody tweeted the amount of time it's been since the U.S. men played. Was it like 280 days or something?
That's too long.
It's something crazy. So yeah, I can't wait to see them back out there. This is the generation of players that we've been excited about for the last few seasons. So here we go. Thursday, we'll have our chance to watch them in action, and we will have a podcast out there probably later that night. You might see it either if you're on the West Coast, you might see it at night. East Coasters might see it the next morning. But yeah, we will have a reaction to that and how these guys looked in this game coming up against Wales. Oh, this was fun, man. This was fun, as always. To you, I say...
Check you later, fun boy.
See ya.
Take care, man.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.